Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Beyond the Darkness. We begin today's episode with a bit of a heavy heart as we say goodbye to a friend to our show and frequent contributor to Coast to Coast AM, Mr. Jim Mars. Jim Mars was best known for his work researching various theories surrounding the JFK assassination, UFOs, and he's been a guest on many talk shows. He died this week at the age of 73. According to his online biography, he was a former Fort Worth Star Telegram staffer starting back in 1968 and was a police reporter and general assignments reporter. Then, after a stint serving in the Army in Vietnam, he came back home and began writing about military and aerospace technology. His 1989 book, Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, was a New York Times paperback nonfiction bestseller and became a basis for the Oliver Stone film JFK in 1991. He served as a chief consultant on the film. He had taught a course on the 1963 killing of the president at the University of Texas at Arlington, starting back in 1976. He retired in 2007. Mars could usually be found in Daly Plaza in Dallas on the anniversary of the assassination every November 22nd, talking to fans and speaking with the media in front of the so-called grassy knoll, ground zero for conspiracy theorists. His work on 9/11 dealt with what he called an inconsistent public story on the terrorist attacks. Other Mars books include Psy Spies, Alien Agenda, Rule by Secrecy, The War on Freedom, The Terror Conspiracy, and The Rise of the Fourth Reich, all of which were met with praise by a devoted community of skeptics, if not mainstream audiences. Tonight, we're going to play one of our favorite episodes, the last episode we revisited last year by Mr. Jim Mars. So please remember him and his family in your thoughts and prayers, and enjoy his final appearance on Darkness Radio.
So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us. The best in paranormal talk radio gets underway in just moments. Joining us for the next 2 hours, Jim Mars, an award-winning journalist and author. After graduating from the University of North Texas with a degree in journalism, Mr. Mars worked for and owned several Texas newspapers before becoming an independent journalist and author. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, which was the basis for the Oliver Stone film JFK, and Rule by Secrecy, his in-depth overview of the UFO phenomena. Alien Agenda is the best-selling nonfiction book of UFOs in the world, and having been translated into several foreign languages, he is a frequent guest on several nationwide radio talk shows, including Coast to Coast AM. He's here with us tonight on Darkness Radio. Mr. Mars, thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, howdy, and it's my pleasure to be with you.
I'm just curious, from Kennedy to UFOs, where did that leap come in for you? Where did you start to realize that you wanted to explore the phenomena of aliens and unidentified craft?
Well, actually, I didn't. That kind of came from the people. Basically, my background is started off as I have a degree in journalism. I'm a journalist. And I started off as a print journalist, and I was in that for 15 years or so. And I kept gravitating towards the strange and unusual. You know, the mayor's office is corrupt. You know, okay, I've heard that story before. You know, let's move on.
Right.
And I've always been curious. And I know at one point I was working on the third floor of Star Telegram, and we had that was before the days of the little enclosed panels, whatever cubicles.
That right.
Okay, we just had one big newsroom. Everybody's in there. Yeah, well, if somebody had run in and said a flying saucer landed in the park across the street and ran out, most of my compadres would go, "Boy, that guy's nuts," and they'd just keep doing what they're doing. me, I'd at least go look out the window, you know, and if I didn't have a clear view, I might even go downstairs and wander over to the park and look around, you know, and then if I didn't see anything, yeah, okay, the guy's full of it, you go on. So I've always kind of gone that way. So after the success of Crossfire, as I'd travel around the country, I'd say, what do you think's the next big, deep, dark, secret government cover-up? And it's really interesting that most people, a huge amount of people, from cab drivers to publishers, said, well, I'd really like to know the truth about the UFOs. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I would too. And so that led to Alien Agenda.
Were you reluctant, though, at that point? I mean, you come off a book about Kennedy and the assassination plot and everything behind that, which, you know, still considered very hard-hitting journalism. And then by mainstream media, a lot of people that turn to, you know, this side, the going to the UFO and alien stuff, a lot of journalists take heat and a hit for that. Were you worried about doing that?
They wouldn't go there. They just go, oh, well, never mind, that's silly stuff. But I didn't buy that. And then the more I looked into it, the more there was just, well, I don't have to tell you. I mean, you've got your, you're digging into the dark universe or darkness radio. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a plethora of information out there regarding UFOs and aliens and alien contact. It's just that most people don't pay any attention to it. And I'm a kind of ashamed for my own profession, because I would go to some of these UFO conventions and I would seek out the former pilots and the air traffic controllers and the military veterans and the police officers who had incredible stories to tell. And then I watched the local TV crew come in and they would look around and they'd spot the guy in the tinfoil hat with a, you know, propeller or something. And that's the guy they go over to interview. And it left the public with the idea that anybody that was truly interested in UFOs must be, you know, a little bit cracked. And you and I both know that's not the case.
No, and that's what always intrigued me. Like you say, you know, you watch the documentaries and they will go for, you know, Giorgio Tsoukalos with the standing up hair. You've got the wild-eyed looks of Stanton Friedman. And although both men are very into this and very intrigued by it, I know that sometimes people get a different perspective from it. Instead of talking to, you know, some of the people in the field that you would look at with respect, pilots and military personnel. But then you look at military personnel, you know,
and there's hundreds of them.
Right. Looking at the Roswell incident and Jesse Marcel, here you've got a pretty prominent figure that everything he kind of claimed ended up just kind of getting dismissed. You know, I mean, it was swept under the carpet and then he let it be for many years until Stanton Friedman helped to bring it back out again. And then it exploded, but he still was always kind of looked at sideways, even though this man had retired a full bird colonel and obviously was somebody that could be trusted and did his job correctly, was still speaking out that what this was a downed alien craft. Yet people still shake their heads and say he was crazy or he made a mistake.
I know. Well, unfortunately, we're turning into a whole country of dumbed down, drugged out dummies that just can't really think rationally, and they can't have deductive reasoning. For example, mentioning Roswell, you know, on the one hand, you have official government pronouncements backed by little or nothing that say, oh, no, nothing really unusual happened there. It was crash dummies, or it was a mogul balloon, or, you know, it misidentified something or another. Okay, nothing much to back that up. On the other hand, you've got probably about 500 or 600 people now on the public record who said, I was there, I picked up pieces of the crash, I carried the bodies to Roswell, I flew the bodies to Fort Worth, to Carswell, flew the bodies then on to up to Ohio, you know, blah, 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 generals, you know, just everyone. So, I mean, you know, who are you going to believe? You know, your government, who has proven so, shall we say, short of the truth in so many instances, from light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam all the way to weapons of mass destruction, all the way to I will not raise taxes, you know.
Right.
You can't believe anything they say, so I don't understand even why there's a big contest about it.
Why do you believe, in your perspective, that the government has kept such a tight lid on this, even though we physically have photographs and witnessed UFOs over Washington, D.C., which is always the go-to, right? If there really are
UFOs,
why not? And that happened.
And they did in 1954.
Right.
No. Well, first you have to understand that there's only five multinational corporations now that have total control over the media and everything. In fact, everything we see and hear, not just news, but cable and TV and movies and magazines and billboards and books and books clubs and magazines, you name it. They're all under the control of a handful of people that own and control these five corporations. And that's where the trouble lies. I know there are people in government, in the military, and it started off this way. Back in the 40s and 50s, they knew there was something in the air, but they didn't know for sure what it was, and therefore they weren't able to stop them, you know. In fact, hey, would you like to hear about the secret UFO war of the 1950s that hardly anybody knows about?
Nah. Don't we have something more fun to talk about? Yeah, but there was a secret. What, Jim?
Okay. Well, now you mentioned the Washington flyover,
right?
Okay. So now that was already causing a big hubbub at the time, and people were really beginning to go, "Gee, you know, I wonder if there's really anything to all this." And so in about 1952, in the wake of all these UFO sightings all across the country and, of course, other countries, the Air Force actually issued orders to their fighter pilots to, if they encountered a UFO, they were to order it to land. If it failed to do so, they were to shoot it. Okay? So they had shoot down orders if they saw a UFO. Well, and fighter pilots then went on a hunt for the flying saucers, with disastrous results. There was a rash of crashes, with perhaps up to 10 fighters lost in just one incident over the Atlantic Ocean. And in June and July of 1951, 94 fighter jets were lost worldwide, with 51 crewmen killed. Planes were just falling to the ground, two and three at a time sometimes. There was a New York Times article that said 192 aircraft vanished or crashed during the years 1951 and 1956. So then all of a sudden the government says, okay, wait a minute, don't shoot at them. Don't shoot at them, okay? If you see a UFO, and first it was to the fighter pilots, you report that to your base commander. If it was commercial pilots, it was you report that to the executives of your respective airlines. Okay, but then very quickly, though, that got tightened up, because then the government says, wait a minute, there's nothing there, but we want to consolidate the reports. So whether you're military or whether you're commercial, you were supposed to contact Washington to a certain office and report your UFO sightings. Well, all the pilots, and especially the commercial pilots, found out very quickly that if they called and reported seeing a UFO, pretty soon these guys in suits would show up and maybe take them off their job for maybe a week or so. They'd lose money. They would risk losing their job. And mostly, these guys, instead of listening and being serious about their reports, would chastise them and mock them. And almost, hey, you sure you don't need psychiatric help and that type of thing. And all the reporting stopped. Okay, that was the end of that. But when the shoot down order was rescinded, all these crashes just kind of stopped. Okay, so I call it the unreported UFO war of the 1950s. Isn't that interesting?
Okay, where would you find this kind of information, Jim? Obviously, the government didn't just, have a secret file of airlines that were shot down by UFOs. Where would we come up with this information?
You would have to go back and dig back into some of the UFO literature that goes all the way back into the 40s and into the early 50s. There's just so much there. For example, the flyover over Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. When that word first came, I mean, there they were in formation flying over Washington. Everybody could see them. So naturally enough, the newsmen rushed to National Airport. And they, in those earlier days, you could actually get in, talk to people, and get what the news was. And they were all crowding in the radar room there at National Airport, because everybody was just amazed, because up until then, everybody had been told that flying saucers were just misidentified aircraft, or maybe some kind of hallucination or maybe some kind of swamp gas or ball lightning. Well, there they were, and there they were on the radar. You know, there was definitely something up there, and they're flying in formation. So what happens? The government runs in and chased all the newsmen out, wouldn't let them go in the radar room anymore, and that allowed them after a few days to argue that it was just a heat inversion. You know, there were just these cold and hot levels in the air, and that was causing people to think they saw stuff. In fact, you know, I go far enough back to where, as a young reporter, you know, we were being told that that there was no such thing as UFOs, that it was either just misidentified aircraft or perhaps mass psychosis. You know, even as a young reporter, I thought, wow, what a story. Heretofore undiagnosed, contagious, mass psychosis.
Sure.
Wow. But see, you never hear that anymore. Yeah, I hadn't heard that in 40 years, okay, because of the advent of the camcorder and, of course, now the cell phone with their cameras. And you go on Google or somewhere and you type in UFOs and, you know, you could probably spend the next year looking at all those pictures out there of these things. And obviously you cannot take a picture of an hallucination or a psychosis.
When you look back at those cases of the secret war that was going on, what is the official word of what these flights encountered during those, shoot downs or why they were dropping out of the sky left and right?
Well, they were suppressed, okay? They didn't report on all this stuff. I have no idea what they said, told the families of these poor guys. Probably, well, you know, he had mechanical trouble and he crashed in the ocean or something. And here's your folded flag and a medal. You know, this is what's going on there. But and that leads back to your original question about why didn't they want to tell us what's going on? Well, okay, several layers there. Way down at the bottom is the fact that to us, people like us, we're really fascinated and really want to know the truth about UFOs, alien activity. But at the level of the Pentagon, they viewed that as exotic technology. And any exotic technology, they figured, could be weaponized. It could be turned into a weapon. So therefore, it was a potential advanced weaponry, which, of course, has to be classified. We can't talk about that. Just like they didn't talk about fashioning the first atomic bomb or the U-2 spy plane or the B-11 or whatever. And so that's one level. Now, up at another level, the political leaders said, well, okay, they're flying over our airspace, and we not only don't know who they are, but they won't stop. We can't stop them. We can't halt them. And as we just discussed the secret UFO war, obviously our technology is not equivalent to theirs. So that there goes the whole foundation for government. And the government, see, has only two true duties. One is to coin and regulate money and tariffs, and the other is to provide for the common defense. Well, if they can't stop them and they fly over our secret installations, then why are we paying all this money for defense? Because they're useless. They can't stop them. So that's another reason. But I'll tell you, the fundamental reason is because, unlike the fairy stories that we hear as children and grow up conditioned to and still hear on the mainstream media, this country is just not run the way we think it is. You know, we think there's Congress and there's the Supreme Court and there's, the presidency and the checks and balances. No. Our country has slowly but surely turned into an oligarchy run by the rich corporate elite, okay? Now, these folks, they don't care if you know there's aliens out there, but the trouble is, if you truly come to believe and understand and know that there's aliens out there, then you also concurrently know that there is alternative technology out there in energy, pharmaceuticals, communications, and oops, that knowledge could very well upset their monopolies over those products and those services that they have a monopoly over. For instance, you know, what would happen to gasoline prices are sagging right now because, contrary to the idea of oil going down, no more oil, contrary to that idea, which has been pretty well debunked, we're in a glut of oil. and the Middle East nations are just pouring it in the pipeline, and so gasoline prices are depressed. Okay, now just think what would happen if all of a sudden everyone actually knew that there were other technologies, I don't know, hydrogen, solar, anything, you know. For example, the German scientist back at the turn of the century who developed the trucks run on, you know, the what I'm trying to think of here, the they didn't run on gasoline.
The diesel?
Yes, thank you.
Diesel. Okay, sure. All right.
Yeah, Adolf Diesel, I think it was. When he invented the diesel engine, it was designed to run on matter, okay, organic matter. And I think one of the reasons I was blocked there for a minute, because every time I think of that, I get tickled because I think of that scene in Back to the Future where he comes back with his DeLorean and they're putting banana peels and coffee grounds and everything in his little atomic converter or whatever it is, you know, and makes it run. Well, that's what Rudolf Diesel actually planned for, was a motor that would run on organic matter. But had an accident. Slipped, fell overboard, crossing the English Channel, and that was the end of him. And now, of course, diesel runs on petroleum fumes, gasoline fumes. And so, see, they're very protective of their monopolies. So they don't care if you know there's aliens out there. They just don't want you to know that there's technology that could break apart their monopolies.
What a strange twist. Jim, when you were starting to research and look into UFO and alien phenomena, what was the first cases you began to dip into to, you know, kind of wet your beak on the subject?
Well, I got sidetracked. After the success of Crossfire, as I said, and people were saying, what about UFOs? That would have been the late 80s, early 90s. And I started looking around, and what did I stumble across but the military's remote viewing program? Okay, you're aware.
Certainly, yeah.
You know about remote viewing. Well, at that time, it was a secret classified special access program, which is even higher than top secret. And I discovered that, and I talked to some of the guys that were doing that. And again, as a journalist and newsman, I said, wow, this is a heck of a story. I said, number one, if it's phony, if that psychic ability is really not there and it's not true, then what a giant waste of the taxpayers' money. But on the other hand, and as I found out, it was true. And they were actually training these military officers in the use of psychic ability, and they were able to cast their mind out and go up in the air around the world and spy on what was going on in Russia, spy, or at that time the Soviet Union, and also spy on other potential enemies. And I just went, holy cow, it's an evolutionary step for mankind. And it was. And then, as I progressed with that, and by the way, I produced a book called PsySpies, PSI Spies, SPIES, Psychic Spies, and it's the true story of America's psychic warfare program. And as I got even deeper and deeper into that and realized that it was a legitimate experiment with legitimate results, it was funded through the CIA, and then, as I said, actually turned into an actual unit within the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. And it was tested at Stanford Research Institute out in California over and over and over and over again. You know, everybody would come in and say, oh, that's hogwash, that can't work. And then they'd test them and they'd get involved in the experience and they'd go, wow, it's real. So the bottom line of that is, and then I wrote a book on that based on my interviews with it, based on my research and everything else, the history, and then it got suppressed. And when I say suppressed, I mean suppressed, because anyone who has any knowledge of publishing knows that if there's some legal reason or some reason that a book cannot be published, then, author has to pay back any advance money that he got. Well, they paid me all of the rest of the advance and then gave me back the rights to the book and just said, no, we're not going to publish this. And that's because it was breaking open the secret program. But the main reason was because every single one of these military remote viewers had personal knowledge and experience with UFOs. Now, some of them will talk about it, some of them won't. Some of them will talk around it a little bit, you know. I remember one kept saying, well, I did have some anomalous viewings, okay. But then, and then others just won't talk about it at all. But there's no question in all of that research that all of them saw the UFOs, which that's another reason they didn't want my book out, because it made the UFOs, keep in mind, this was like the early to mid-90s, and they didn't want everybody knowing that. And in fact, just within a few weeks after my book had been canceled, the CIA issued a report and said, we've been looking into this psychic phenomenon known as remote viewing, but we don't feel like we were really getting much out of it, and just thought you'd like to know. You know, hey, wait a minute. When's the CIA ever broken open one of their secret programs? You know, so there was a huge cover-up going on. And still today, a lot of people have heard about remote viewing, but only from the mainstream media and only from movies and things where they come up to and almost make fun of the whole thing, just act like there wasn't anything there. But
can I ask, Jim, when you say that each one had some kind of experience, does that mean that they were being told to remote view UFOs, or
no,
while they were doing what
not.
They were doing, were they coming into contact with alien energy or forces? I don't know what you want to call it.
No, they were, you know, because supposedly and officially, according to the government, there were no such things, you know. So no, they were never tasked to go look for UFOs. It was this. But for example, they would be tasked, say, to go up in the upper atmosphere and look for high-performance aircraft. And the idea being, what are the Russians testing? What are the Chinese testing, you know? Well, they'd go up there, they'd look at these things, and as one of them told me, he said, those guys weren't even from the neighborhood, okay? They weren't us. And that's what I'm talking about. Ingo Swann, who was one of the early experimenters with the remote viewing and probably one of the best remote viewers they had, there were a few others, but he was one of the better ones. And he told me one time about that he was tasked to go look at some new type Russian submarine. And when he went there, there was this circular craft hanging over it in the air. And naturally, his attention was drawn to this craft, you know, more than just a run-of-the-mill submarine. And when he got back, and when he was, you know, filling out his reports and everything, the interrogators would say, well, wait a minute, what about the submarine? He said, I didn't care about the submarine. I wanted to see this round object that was hanging over in the air. And they said, are you talking about a flying saucer? And he said, yeah. So they just, you know, they all accept it. If you really get to know them, get talking to all these guys, they just, they come here and they go there. And, they're in Air Force parlance, they're called fast walkers. And these are ships that come into our atmosphere and leave our atmosphere. And they're not us.
Were they, did any of these remote viewers relate that while they were remote viewing these beings, that these beings or these crafts seemed to notice them?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they definitely realized that there was somebody looking in on them. You see, the idea of remote viewing and the idea of being able to use this psychic power, we all have it. That's one of the things they found in the research at Stanford Research Institute, was that they bring people off the street and test them and find, they could do it. We all have this ability. But, of course, that's like saying you and I both have the ability to play Chopin on the piano. I don't know about you. You may be a great pianist, so maybe you can do it. But I know I'm still at the, dun, 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 dun. I'm at that level. But the point is that we both have the ability, okay? If I studied music a lot, got me a good music teacher, and then practice, I could play Chopin on the piano. So could you. So could anybody. All right, so the psychic ability is the same way. Now, some people have a little bit more natural ability for it and can kind of just jump right into it, and then others have to struggle, but we can all do it. And here's the clincher, too. This thing that just boggled my mind is that this ability is not limited by time or space. You can go back in the past and look at things. You can go into the future and look at things. You can go out into space and look at things. Back in the early 70s, Ingo Swann and another psychic, went out and took a psychical look at Jupiter. And they said, okay, wow, it's got a little ring around it that we hadn't been able to see, and it's got a modest but nevertheless present magnetic field. And it's clouds, none of that. There's big mountains, huge mountain ranges and stuff. Well, the scientific community says, well, that all sounds good, but we don't know that. How do we know that? Nobody knows that. And then in the late 70s, about 1977, is when they launched Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And when they got out there and had flybys by Jupiter and send all of the data back, what do we find? It's got a little ring around it. It's got a magnetic field. It's got clouds. It's got mountain ranges under it. And so the psychics were proven completely correct. And now that gets even to weirder things, such as the loss of the Phobos 2, which was a probe sent by the Russians to study Phobos, the moon of one of the moons of Mars, which a lot of people, including Russian scientists and even some scientists over here, said that it appeared to be not natural. Whoa. Well, the Phobos 2 got there, and then it was lost. They lost all contact with it. And then, you may recall, a few years after that, they sent the Mars Observer. We did. We sent the Mars Observer out there. It got to Mars, and we lost contact with that. And I, when the Mars Observer was lost, I got in contact with some of these remote viewers I'd been dealing with, and I said, what happened to the Mars Observer? And they said, same thing happened to the Phobos 2. Well, what happened to the Phobos 2? They said, well, they remote viewed it, and they saw that as both of those probes came into the atmosphere of Mars, that circular-shaped object rose off the surface of Mars and came out to meet them. And one said the analogy would be the tugboats coming out to meet the Queen Mary. Well, they came out and they scanned these probes from Earth and then realized that it wasn't theirs. So the object turned around, went back to Mars. But in the process of scanning the two probes, the Phobos 2 and the Mars Observer, these electromagnetic beams or whatever they were probing with scrambled the onboard computer. We lost contact, and they just tumbled in the atmosphere of Mars and burned up. So, you know, okay, there's a real interesting story, but was there any feedback? Is there any way of knowing if that was true? Well, I have a drawing that one of the viewers made. You could see the landing leg of the Phobos 2. And they drew the little object, and it was kind of teardrop shape, but more irregular, okay? Well, a few years later, after the Cold War collapsed, one of the Russian cosmonauts, Marina Popovich, was visiting here in the United States, and I think she was in San Francisco, and she had a news conference, and she held up one of the last photographs taken from a photo, too, and they had already announced that they had photographed some object approaching the Phobos 2, and then before it shut down, and then they lost all contact. Well, in this photograph of this object that was approaching the Phobos 2, it's kind of tear-shaped but irregular. It looks amazingly similar to what the remote viewers had drawn. So, see, there are ways of penetrating what's going on, but you're not going to get it through any mainstream corporate-controlled media outlet.
Jim, remote viewing. I mean, when you start hearing stories of this and you hear that these people have this ability to see outside of the conscious physical form and be able to relate tactile sensations, smells, visual contact. I mean, that sounds like something you'd find in an L. Ron Hubbard book. That sounds like Isaac Asimov.
Certainly does. And that's why I was highly, highly skeptical
sure.
of going into it. Okay. But hey, I've done it myself, and I find that it works. I won't go into that story, but the bottom line is I remote viewed into the future and drew a 100% accurate floor plan for an office building that had not yet been built.
Wow.
And then a year
explain
later,
that to me.
After it had been built, and I went and visited this place, and I go, wow, that's kind of what I saw when I was doing my meditative remote viewing, and then they gave me a copy of the official floor plan, and it was 100% what I had sketched. So I know from personal experience that it works.
Jim, can you tell us, as an outsider then, somebody who wasn't part of these government programs to learn this, as somebody, you know, layman who is able to be trained and then do this for yourself, what is that experience like when you make a connection outside of consciousness?
Well, it is not what you would expect. I can tell you right now, if you sit in a chair and get very meditative and get real relaxed and take slow breaths and relax, you know, and then you close your eyes, and if you get a very clear picture, say, of a South Sea Island beach with a grass hut and the palm trees and the gulls flying over, that's not remote viewing, okay? It's a very, very soft signal that you, and in kind of an intuitive feeling that you get. Some of your listeners may have had the experience where they're just going through their normal day, and they just kind of get this feeling like, you know, my mom's going to call. And then the next thing you know, the phone rings, and it's your mom. You know, that's what it is. It's a very, very subtle thing. And speaking of the L. Ron Hubbard thing, and speaking of the, you know, his book, Battlefield Earth, was based on the premise that the Voyager 1, Voyager 2, which was, as I said, was launched in 1977, and this was written in the early 80s. He said, it's out there broadcasting our kind of our location, kind of a roadmap to the planet Earth. And here just recently, Stephen Hawking, you know, voiced publicly some concern about that, about, you know, maybe it's not a really good idea to put out into the universe, you know, where we are, because, well, and Hubbard even made the same analogy in the interview. He says, you know, what if somebody had told the North American natives that these white guys were going to arrive with flaming sticks, and that you know, that their whole civilization was going to kind of be wiped out? They would have said, "Well, you can't tell us that. That's a wild science fiction story." But you know, these things have happened after Columbus discovered America, so to speak, and there'd be a huge argument there. But he arrived actually in the Caribbean, the island of Cuba, what we now call Cuba, and others, and they brought with them the European diseases, and within a few years, you know, thousands of the native inhabitants had been wiped out, not because of even any hostile acts, just because they brought disease with them. And of course, H.G. Wells turned that whole concept around when the Martians invaded the Earth in his 1896 book, War of the Worlds. And our technology couldn't match them. They had their tripod machines that were just blowing up everything. What finally won the battle for Earth was the Earth germs, and they weren't ready for it, and they were susceptible to them, and it killed them all off. So actually Hubbard was kind of ahead of his time, because in Battlefield Earth, it's interesting that it's not an overt invasion. It's not like they just come here to blow up everything like in that movie Independence Day. It's just a business deal, okay? The intergalactic bankers have loaned money to the Intergalactic Mining Corporation, and they have a contract to come and basically strip mine the Earth for mineral resources. But of course, they found these pesky humans in the way, so they brought in these huge hairy aliens from Cyclos to act as a security force, and thus begins a 1,000-year occupation of the planet Earth.
And Jim, we have to take a quick break. We'll come back and find out how much is science fiction, how much is reality with what might be going on in the world around us. Are aliens visiting? Are we in some kind of intergalactic deal with them? We'll talk more with our guest, Jim Mars, when we return. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Good evening and welcome back to the show. Darkness Radio is on the air. Still with us this hour, Jim Mars, as we talk about an alien agenda and so much more. Jim, when you're researching and looking into these cases, and there's such conspiracy and such an agenda to hide information, how do you know that the people that you're getting information from are giving you legitimate information, not disinformation, not misinformation?
Well, I don't. That's why, as a good journalist, I listen to everybody. I don't ignore anybody, and I don't just accept from just everybody or anybody. But I have what I call my huff file, okay? If I get a piece of information, whether it's political or astronomical or alien or whatever, you know, and I just said, And so I put it in the huff file. And then I wait, and I don't write about that or speak publicly about it until I get more input, more data, more information coming in. And as it comes in, it piles up. It will generally tell you that this information is correct or this information is not correct, or it just remains in the huff file. A good example of that is the idea that we have a secret space fleet, okay? Well, when I first heard that, I thought, yeah, come on, that's not right. And it was in my definitely in my huff file. But, you know, there's been more and more information coming out. And then, for instance, Gary McKinnon, who hacked into the Pentagon computers and found the officers and the names of the ships and all like that. And then you put that together with the stories about that the Pentagon now says it can't really account for more than $8 trillion, you know. Yeah. Gee, I had it when it came in. You know, wait a minute. Come on. You tell me you can't keep up with that kind of money? Where'd that go? Well, it could have gone to a secret space fleet. So I'm not here to tell you that I'm convinced that it's there. I'm not here to convince you or to tell you that I have definite proof that we have a secret space fleet. I'm just saying it's still in my huff file, but it's kind of gotten towards the front.
Okay. Right. When they lost that $8 trillion, weren't the records kept in that part of the Pentagon that was hit by the plane on 9/11,
yeah,
reportedly?
Exactly. Back then, it wasn't quite so much. Back then, the day before, on September the 10th of 2001, the day before 9/11, Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, publicly announced that they could not account for $2.3 trillion. And interestingly enough, who would have been in charge of trying to track where that money went? That would have been the Army's accounting office. And interestingly enough, the next day on September the 11th, the Pentagon was struck on a largely unoccupied West Wing, and the people who suffered the most casualties was the Army accounting office. I'm sure just a coincidence, of course.
Obviously.
Now, think about this one, though. When I was thinking about back to the Voyager 1 and 2, and Voyager 1, which is, by the way, now outside our solar system, and as far as I know, still functioning, still sending data back. On board is a golden disk, mm-hmm. and on here they have a drawing of a human male, drawing of a human female, and a kind of a diagram showing where Earth is. This is what has prompted some of this concern, like from Stephen Hawking, about maybe we shouldn't be advertising where we are. We might not like who we guide here, you know. But also on there is music and recordings from all around the world.
Right.
It includes tribal chants and, even, of course, the classic composers, Chopin and Beethoven. But what kills me is some blues from Blind Willie Johnson and Johnny B. Good from Chuck Berry, you know. And what do you think aliens out towards the center of the galaxy is going to think if they pick this thing up and they hear Chuck Berry singing Johnny B. Good?
My guess is if they're actually capable of having a record player to play that golden album, they'll probably enjoy it quite a bit. I just never understood why we sent a golden record to outer space with no way to play it.
On the expectation that they have a record player, right? Well, this is kind of like the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, you know. I saw a great cartoon one time that showed a guy who looked suspiciously like the famous scientist. And he's sitting at a console, and it says CETI on it. And he's going, well, nothing here. Let's switch to another channel, you know. Meanwhile, the window behind him is open, and out the window we see a UFO lifting a cow into the air and a crop circle forming and somebody else being pulled up into a saucer, you know. And so it is kind of interesting that these CETI people, they will not tell you there's aliens out there, but they're spending all kinds of money trying to send radio signals out into the galaxy as if those people out there are going to be using old electronic, you know, electromagnetic radio waves anyway. You know, they're probably doing something a little more sophisticated than that.
Right, but the idea would probably be, much like us, that we've got an array that's listening for different frequencies, different kinds of connection. It would only, you would only think if there are other races that are as advanced or more advanced than ours, they would also be sending out an array looking for those.
That's true.
That would
That's
be
true.
The most basic communication.
You're aware that we have actually picked up some signals.
Right.
Unfortunately, they don't repeat, and we can't always duplicate the thing, so nobody can actually claim anything. But they picked up several times signals that appear to be unnatural, shall we say. So, you know, well, look, come on. Let's face it, folks. Do you really believe that a universal creative God would create billions of galaxies containing billions of suns and billions of planets, you know, just so we'd have something to look at in the night sky? You know, that's a pretty arrogant way of looking at the universe. And when you really stop and look at it, like Carl Sagan's, you know, billions and billions of stars. And when you really look at it, the Earth is just kind of one little third-rate mud ball circling around a rather third-rate sun out on the outer edge of the Milky Way galaxy. So, you know, who are we to think we're the center of the universe?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the way it has to be looked at, too, is there's too much out there to not think that we're, you know, to think that we're alone, to just think that this is it. And we're the top. Jim, I've got to ask then, just out of curiosity, what your thoughts and beliefs are on the lunar landing. Do you believe that we ever made it to the moon?
Well, I was in the Army at the time in 1969. And I remember I was at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, with a whole bunch of soldiers. And we were in this great big hall, and we were all there when they said, you know, one small step for man, one giant step for mankind. We cheered. We were so proud. We were so good. And I even remember I think it was 62 when Kennedy, you know, pledged that we were going to have a man on the moon by the end of the decade. That's something people need to keep in mind. You know, actually, when it got to the space race, the Russians were kicking our butts, okay? They put the first satellite up. They put the first dog, Laika. They put the first woman into space. They put the first astronaut into space. They, you know, they were really just tearing us up. And the people, the leadership in America, you know, we just had to show the world that we could do something. And Kennedy said he pledged, you know, our national honor, that we're going to have a man on the moon before the end of the decade. And when did the moon landing happen? August 1969. You're only a few months away from the turn of the decade. Now, so back to when I was there, I for the longest time, I would not even look hard and seriously at the idea of did we go to the moon, because it just seemed so obviously absurd, as it does, I'm sure, today to a lot of people. But you know what? That's one of these cases where it's in the huff file, but as the data comes in, just one small, for example, NASA says, when we ask, where's the original tapes of the moon landing so we can kind of study them and maybe we can now forensically tell, who made them and when they were made and what kind of tape it was. Oh, well, they've lost it. They didn't think we really cared about that, you know, so somebody taped over them. They don't have the original moon landing tapes. What? What?
Right.
This is only one of the most, extraordinary achievements in the history of the whole human race. And they didn't think we were interested. They taped over it, and they don't have the original tapes anymore. Excuse me. Something is kind of stinky in Denmark. Okay?
Well, in their defense, though, Jim, everybody wanted to know who killed JR, so they had to find a tape to record it on.
That's true. Come on, we got to keep our priorities.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's really, when you look at some of this stuff, it's insane what's going on. This election is driving me nuts. You know, I don't have a whole lot good to say about Trump. I mean, obviously he's kind of boorish and he's kind of vulgar and he's but then so was Lyndon Johnson. You know, so was many of our other former presidents. But the thing to me is, on the one hand, you have a lot of accusations, a lot of innuendo, but nothing provable. But then on the other hand, you get the head of the FBI that said Hillary Clinton has violated 47 laws, you know. But that's all right. We're going to give her a pass because she's Hillary. I mean, to me, I don't even understand why there's any big contest here. You got a known versus an unknown, and the known is holy cow, you know, pay for play. You know, enabling a serial rapist. I mean, how can people equate foul talk, you know, or uncouth talk with actual rape? There's three people who said he raped me. You know, come on. I don't get it. I just don't get it. But then I don't get a lot of things, so that's why I go and investigate things.
Right. Got to take a look at these calls, see what makes sense, what doesn't. And the reason I'm not trying to put you under the microscope when we talk about the lunar landing, but it just seems that, you know, there are some experts that come down on the side that there's no way we could make it through the Van Ryan belt. There's no way that we could successfully do these things. That's why we haven't gone back there. You know, that there's...
Yeah, well, even Van Allen himself. Here's another discrepancy. You know, everybody I know of that is savvy to photography, number one, they didn't take any lighting with them to the moon. We know that, and NASA has confirmed that. They didn't take any lighting with the moon, and yet these moon pictures, you know, you can see one side of the lunar lander lit up, and you can see the underside lit up. Where'd that light source come from? You would think that from the moon with its, the moon with its thin atmosphere, almost non-existent atmosphere, that you'd be able to see stars and stars. I live in Texas, out in a rural area. I can see the Milky Way, okay, on a night with my eyes. You tell me from the moon you can't see any stars? I mean, they didn't have any light shining around anywhere. There's just too many questions, okay? And then they back to Van Allen. The photographic experts say there's no way they could have carried videotape or photograph film or anything back through the Van Allen belt because that the radiation would have smudged the film, right, and caused a problem. Well, NASA answers that by saying, well, actually the Van Allen belt's only about 20 miles wide, and they went through it real fast, you know. Well, Van Allen himself, I've seen interviews with him, and he said, no, it extends more than 100 miles. So you go to 100 miles of radiation and you don't fog any of the film. And again, NASA's explanation is that, well, actually it's not 100 miles, it's only about 20 miles. And they went through it real fast. So that's kind of like saying if you'll run real fast through the rainstorm, you won't get wet.
Well, isn't it, but with that same theory, if it's beaming back messages to us, you know, these different satellites, these different probes that we've sent out there, they've got to go through radiation belts. How is it not degrading, especially, you know, some of the Mars rover photograph imagery is so crystal clear.
I know.
How is that possible?
So much of the other of it is just real muddy.
Right.
You know, and yet we know, you know, or should know, that we have satellites here carrying cameras with lenses that are so good that you could step outside in your front yard in Los Angeles, California, with a beer can. They can read the label on the beer can. That's how good they are, okay? And yet when we get these photographs from Mars, a little fuzzy part over here, and it's a little blurry over there, and, well, we're not quite close enough to get that one. No, there's just something not right about the whole thing. And, of course, that's why NASA, some people say that stands for never a straight answer.
Well, let's look at SpaceX, this, you know, independent space programs now that have been talked about. You know, and NASA and some of the other industries have said, okay, let's let them see what they can do. And all of a sudden there's
what happened to the Falcon 9?
Right.
It goes up and blows up.
Now, the imagery from that is intriguing. Now, I can't tell that they're not just capturing a bird in the background that's flying past and, you know, from the angle and the low degradation of the film that they've got, something that just happened
anything.
To be there.
Yeah, but Musk, you know, the head of SpaceX, has said that they're not ruling out a UFO. They're not ruling out anything. So, well, I guess we'll just have to keep that one in a Huff file until we get further input. But I can tell you something.
Well, right, but on his side, wouldn't that be a good PR tool? First of all, it keeps interest. You know, wow, aliens might be involved. Second of all, then you keep the heat off of it wasn't us. It wasn't our failure of technology, obviously.
That's right. It was a third-party interview.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, we were ready to go, and they're trying to stop us.
Well, you know what? I'd almost buy into that completely, except for the idea that I've been doing this now for a long time. And as I mentioned, the remote viewing of Phobos 2 and the Mars Observer, there are other times here that multiple times when we're sending up a communication satellite or some kind of, you know, prosaic thing, and it seems to be no trouble. And yet, I know during my years as a newsman, we get word that there's going to be a launch next Wednesday, but it's classified as military implications, so we're not, you know, it's not going to, there's not going to be any reporting on it. And these are the ones that seem to, gee, we lost them, or they blew up. 1993, the Titan IV, they launched that one, and it blew up at 100,000 feet. Okay, now what possibly could be, you're not going to have a bird at 100,000 feet. Excuse me. But, and then they came out, Space News said, well, they blamed it on some kind of defect in the motor or something. And yet Frank Sterling, the project manager, said the Air Force had film of something coming down through the atmosphere and striking the Titan IV. SpaceX... And the is not the only instance of this happening, and you know, that leads to some of the researchers to suspect that perhaps we're being quarantined here. They say, you want to play with nuclear weapons? Fine. You want to fight amongst yourself? Okay, that's your business, but you're not bringing it into space.
Interesting aspect of that, right? I mean, even our human nature and warlike attitude is resonated that far. That kind of begs the...
I'll tell you, it went that far, and when the interest started was 1945. We set off an atomic bomb.
Right.
Okay. And when you start messing at the atomic level, then you're not just messing with the Earth. You know, when you start interrupting at the atomic and subatomic level, that has perturbations and effects that ripple out through the entire galaxy, you know, perhaps the universe. And that, I think, is when somebody way out there said, oh, my God, the kids have found the matches. You know, and they started visiting here, and all of a sudden we had the flying saucer flaps. They've been here all along, but they really doubled down after the we were setting off atomic bombs, and all the way up through Kennedy era, we were setting off hundreds of nuclear explosions, and they probably were going, holy cow, you know, they're going to wreck their own planet. And that's why, as you're probably well aware, you probably had guests on that were talking about this, through the 60s, 70s, there would be UFO flyovers over some of our nuclear installations, and particularly over our military installations, and the launch codes would be messed with. And, of course, people like Colonel Corso that I interviewed, he thought that was a hostile act. You know, I said, yeah, in your whole book, you act like they're enemies. Why is that? And he said, well, they'd fly over our most secret military installations. We'd order them to stop, and they wouldn't stop. Oh, well, my God, you know.
Well, aren't you curious? We ordered them to stop. How? How do we know that they've got a radio? What are we using to try to communicate?
Exactly.
Are we standing outside with a bullhorn going, yo, no, don't
maybe
do this?
Put giant letters on the roof that says stop.
Right.
Yeah. No, obviously, I think they were using radio. But see, that's pretty interesting right there. How do we know they have a receiver that would actually receive, you know, whatever we're broadcasting? You would think if they're able to travel through space and get here, that they would at least be able to understand radio signals, but who knows, you know? It's really wild. And so my thought always was is that, okay, so they're tampering with the nuclear launch codes. Corso and a lot of other people see that as a hostile enemy act. I'm thinking maybe they're saving our bacon. Maybe they're stopping us from launching nuclear bombs all around the world and killing off everybody.
Right. Maybe they're showing that they're testing their own abilities to say, okay, when it gets bad and the way these people are going, it's going to get bad. We need to know that we can shut this down and we can shut it down fast.
Yeah, exactly. See, that's an interesting viewpoint. And yeah, I always try to look at kind of the whole thing, you know. Sometimes it's just in our perception. Let's say you and I and another guy are walking through the woods. A little green diminutive figure races across in front of us, runs off into the woods. You may say, wow, I just saw an alien. And the other guy might say, no, I saw a demon. And I'd say, no, it was a leprechaun. You know, the reality is there.
Right.
It's our perception that changes, and
well,
our perceptions are built on our experience and background and conditioning. I got to mention one thing because L. Ron Hubbard's book, The Battlefield Earth, which, by the way, is number three on the top 100 novels of the 20th century or something like that. And I remember I read that when it first came out. I was thoroughly intrigued. And, of course, then they made that stupid movie.
John Travolta, yeah.
Yeah, with Travolta. And it kind of, you know, but you know what happened there? And it happens all the time. Is that I'll read a really, really good story or a novel, and then, oh, wow, there's the movie. And then you go see the movie, and you go, wow, they didn't even follow the book.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened there. But let me tell you what they've got going that really intrigues me, because I've actually listened to a portion of this. Unfortunately, I hadn't had time to listen to the whole 47 hours of a...
You're such a quitter, Mars.
I know it. I just give up real quick. I'm sorry that the Cubs were on, you know. but anyway, it's amazing. 47 hours, you can get it in a little flash drive. It's all on this whole thing. And I think you can get it off Amazon for like $2. Go to battlefieldearth.com. You can read all about it. But they have 67 voice actors portraying 198 characters from this book, more than 150,000 sound effects, and a full musical score written especially for this thing. I call it a movie for the mind. Okay, if you're a truck driver or you face a daily long commute or whatever, I can't think of anything better than to listen to Battlefield Earth in this audio version. It's really amazing. But then, you know, guys, I hate to date myself, but I go back to pre-TV. When I was a kid, there was no TV. And what we do, I don't know about everybody else, but...
You hung out on the Internet, obviously, right?
Yeah, they didn't have the Internet either.
What?
But what they had was radio.
Right.
And I would lie in bed at night, and my parents thought I was probably sleeping, but I wasn't. I had it turned real low, and I had it next to my bed, and I'd turn on the radio, and I'd listen to Gangbusters, The Inner Sanctum, Gunsmoke, Tarzan. All these things were radio programs, you know,
sure.
Along with, of course, the comedies like Burns and Allen and Amos and Andy and all like that. And you'd lie there, and you'd listen to, like, The Shadow. You know, what evil lurks in the hearts of men, the shadow knows. And then they, you know, very, very expressive voice characterizations. And you would lay there and you would picture everything in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way this Battlefield Earth thing is. It kind of brought me back that same kind of feeling where you get to picture what everything looks like. You can hear what the voices sound like. You hear what the story is. But it's up to you to picture it. And I think for everybody raised on TV and movies and now DVDs and everything else and computers, I think that might be an interesting experience for them.
Great. Well, our listeners love that kind of stuff, so they can check it out for themselves. But talking about the idea and the nature behind these aliens, so many people are worried, you know, and you've got guys like Stephen Hawking, considered one of the greatest minds of our time, saying right. Maybe we shouldn't be sending messages. Maybe we shouldn't be reaching out. But isn't the fact that if they're out there, if we've been in communication with them, if they were so malevolent, they could have stopped us, squashed us, taken over long ago.
Long ago. Absolutely. That's what I try to tell people, is that if there was a race out there that was so hostile, they're going to come here Independence Day, blow up everything, try to kill everybody. You know, why do they wait till now? Why didn't they come here when all we had to defend ourselves with was bows and arrows and spears? And the thing is, I taught a course on UFOs from 2000 to 2007 at the University of Texas at Arlington. And one of the first assignments I would give the class is to go and then come back and make a report on a UFO event that happened prior to the year 1900. And they'd all look at me like, what? You know, because most people only know about Roswell. A few people now know about Aurora 1897. But they'd go, what? And then when they come back the next week, everybody would be so excited because they went. And once you really go and look, you'll find that there's been reports of flying objects. Well, you know, Old Testament, Ezekiel and the fiery wheel that picked him up, carried him around, showed him places, dropped him off over here and there. You know, all the way back through all recorded history, even the ancient Sumerians, who predate the Egyptians by 5,000 or 6,000 years, have written in their cuneiform clay tablets about the Anunnaki, translated as those who come from the heavens and landed on the earth. Okay, so it goes all the way back through history. So they've been here all along, and which again raises the question, I wouldn't worry about an overt alien invasion, because if that was the game plan, they would have done that long before now. Now, the big question, and you raised it, I think, before the break, was, you know, are they benevolent or are they malevolent? Are they good or bad? And all I can tell people is, look, see the commercial jet airliner flying over your head? You know it's full of people. Are they good or are they bad? You know, probably a mixture of both.
Right? Sure.
And so I think we got a little bit of all that, but I don't think that we have to worry about an overt invasion just yet. And so it's, I don't know. I think it's, this is something, of course, you're going to have to individual study and research. But I think you'll figure out that they've been here all along. But then that brings an interesting question. You know, I was writing about these ancient astronauts in my book, Alien Agenda, which was published in the 90s. And then I have a new, recent book out called Our Occulted History, which kind of takes off from that and traces the ancient astronauts all the way up to the current day. Because, you know, if indeed there were non-humans visiting on the Earth in prehistoric times or even biblical times or way back there, ancient astronauts as we now call them, okay, if that was true, then, you know, how could we prove that? Well, I say all you have to do is look at the historical record. If, as we are taught in school, we just evolved from cavemen and then were farmers and then you gathered in small communities and then cities and towns and then nation states and then the empires, you know, which is, that's what we're taught, then the whole historical record, there shouldn't be anything but that slow evolutionary march forward by humankind. But that's not what we found. You looked in the historical record and everything from the Hindu Vayamas, the Vedas, that talk about the Vayamas, the flying machines that could destroy a whole city with one blast. You got the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that Lot and his family were warned about. So this was not a earthquake or a volcano that nobody expected. This was somebody knew this was going to happen. And then you've got the traces of radioactivity in the Sinai and over in India And so, wow, then you come on up through the flying boats of the Egyptians and the flying shields reported by the Romans, and then you get into medieval times, and there's ancient, you know, these ancient paintings showing these weird little round objects flying through the sky, and, you know, hey, wait a minute, historical record shows us that somebody's been here all along. So now that raises a real interesting question, was, well, if some of these spacefarers, extraterrestrials, if you will, if they're still here, or at least some of them are still here, whoa, then who are they, where are they, and what do they want? And I would submit to you that you connect the dots by looking at the people who are preaching against this new world order, okay? Because it's quite obvious that there is a small clique of individuals who are at least trying to run the world, and they're doing it through financial. They're doing it through banks. There was a 2011 study done in by the Swiss Institute of Technology that showed that out of 43,000 multinational corporations, you could find cross-ownership and directorship linking these back to basically 147 companies, which in turn were controlled by about 20 banks. Okay, now that is intense, centralized economic control over the planet. All right? And now, well, wait a minute then, okay? If they're still here and there's somebody trying to economically run the world, you know, maybe it's time we seriously ask this elite, this 1%, this, you know, whatever they want to call it, New World Order, whatever, maybe we need to seriously ask if they're even us.
That's a great question to pose. Are we far from a full disclosure? Do you think that will happen in the next 50 years here, Jim, or is this going to be a cat and mouse game for all of our eternity here?
Well, you know, I've been through the ringer. I've heard this for years. Oh, it's next year. No, it's 2 years from now. You know, now, you know, it's going to be 2010. No, it's 2012. And now it's, I think the latest one they say is going to be 2017. Okay. The good news is, I really do believe that we are very close to disclosure. In fact, actually, we may have already had disclosure because there's so much out there that, it's going to be up to the individual. Now, if you're waiting around for some government official to hold a press conference and say, okay, we've lied to you for 70 years, here's the real truth, that ain't going to happen. No politician could stand that heat, okay? So, but what's happening is it's just dribbled out here and there and everything. We've been conditioned by radio and movies. The polls in the 1950s show that nobody believed, virtually nobody, I mean like 90% or more of the respondents, did not believe there's any kind of life outside the Earth. Today, the same polls show quite the reverse. Most everybody, especially younger folks who were brought up on Star Wars and Star Trek, and, you know, they go, yeah, okay, sure, you know, there's aliens out there. So, see, we kind of have disclosure right now for the people who are open to it, but for true disclosure, for something to happen that everybody, no matter how, you know, stiff they are in their opposition to the idea, can look up and go, holy cow, you know, there they are. That's not up to us. That's up to them. If you'll think about it, all they got to do is come hang out over a city long enough for the news crews to get out there and start taping, and then, whoop, the game's up, right? So the good news is I really think that we are close to open disclosure like that, because anyone who's is pretty literate and has read the literature, anyone who keeps up or goes to these seminars or conventions or whatever, and I'm not just talking about maybe like Star Trek conventions. I'm talking about UFO conventions, alien conventions. I just got back from San Francisco with the very first Alien Con. Whoa. And you know what? They were standing room only. They had people lined up all around the hotel. In fact, I quipped at one of the panels. I said, you know, I got an idea for lessening this congestion and traffic here. I said, next year for the Alien Con, we're only going to allow in people who don't believe in aliens. And I think it's true. I think most people are now at least open to the idea, as opposed to the ones that are going, nah, it's all nonsense. Don't listen to that, you know. So I think disclosure actually has probably already happened. We're just kind of in between here with a mass of people realizing that it's all true and that we're not the only, intelligent species in the universe, if we can even call ourselves an intelligent species.
There is that. Jim, I want to ask you real quickly. I want to wrap up with making sure we mention your new book as well. And I would love to invite you back with your new book on our True Crime Tuesday.
About my latest book, Population Control, How Corporate Owners Are Killing Us. And guys, the reason for this, the reason I'm so adamant about people need to read this book is because UFOs, aliens, Kennedy, all this stuff, that's all great. That's all interesting and it's all very worthwhile. But hey, this gets into the realm of self-defense. If you don't understand what they're putting in your food, they're putting in your water, they're putting in your vaccines, what they're putting into your air that you breathe, you know, then you're in big trouble, and you need to have this information so you can protect yourself and your loved ones.
And we want to discuss that. We do True Crime Tuesday every week. And, Jim, I would love to have you come back and talk about that and the trillion-dollar conspiracy to discuss these different aspects of, you know, people always consider serial killers and strange mysteries crime, but this might be the biggest crime being perpetrated on us, the people of the United States and of the world, and we need to take a look at this. So can we
Amen,
get you?
Amen, brother. You're absolutely right.
I'm with you, and it's killing us.
I was seeing the other day something like 6 million people a year die all around the world just because of air pollution.
Right. You know,
leading cause of death in the United States today is conventional medical treatment.
Right, and we need to start asking questions when we're going to be out and send food to foreign countries and countries that are hard hit, and they're refusing our aid because of what we put in our food.
That's right.
It's time that we start taking a hard-edged look at this and know that maybe what we're doing is not in our best interest. But the question then remains, and we'll have to dig deeper into that when we have you on a True Crime Tuesday, Jim, is, but what can we do? You talk about all these powerhouses that are behind it and in control. What can we do? Where do we stand?
To kick off the argument that we'll talk about at some future show is that what you do is you grow your own vegetables, you grow your own fruits, you know, you get organic, you buy locally produced stuff. But you know what? The federal government is taking one step after another to outlaw all that.
Right.
They're going to force you to take that processed food. I saw one of the major soft drink manufacturers, you know, I think it was Pepsi-Cola, has announced that they're taking aspartame out of their diet drinks.
Right.
You know, which is great. Aspartame, it turns to formaldehyde in your brain, okay? But anyway, but then they've replaced it with sucralose, which is just about as bad. See, so people need to know about this stuff so they can protect themselves.
Well, we will keep in touch with you. I'll have our producer, Amy, reach out to you and see what we can do to set you back up on a True Crime Tuesday. And let's get into this book. We're going to put a link up to the new book, Population Control, How Corporate Owners Are Killing Us. Jim Mars, the author of the new book, just out August 30th, 2016. We'll have him back for that. We'll also put up links to his website so you can find him and more information that you've heard tonight on the show. Jim, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you, sir, and we look forward to doing it again real soon.
Well, this has been really great, and I appreciate the opportunity. You guys and everybody listening, and have a really good rest of the week.
Stay safe. Stay safe, Jim. You're spreading a lot of good information out there, and that can't be making people happy.
Well, yeah, that's true. Oh, that's all right. I live in Texas.
That's true.
We got a lot of guns down here.
Let them come get you in Texas, right?
Yeah, bring them on.
Jim,
thank you, guys.
Jim Mars, our guest this evening. We'll have him back again real soon for True Crime Tuesday. His new book, Population Control, How Corporate Owners Are Killing Us. You need to read this book and review it for yourself. Thank you all for tuning in and being part of our world. We'll be back with you next week. And remember tomorrow night to tune in to the best in overnight talk radio as I host Coast to Coast AM. This is Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis from Beyond the Darkness.